You're listening to Their Finest Hour, a podcast from the University of Oxford.
The white cliffs of Dover, tomorrow, just you wait and see.
I'm joined today by Amandeep Madra, who is the chairperson of the UK Punjab Heritage Association. He is here to talk to us about the work of his association and about Punjab heritage and the martial tradition that the people of the Punjab have rendered for many, many centuries, and more prescient to this particular podcast, in the two world wars, and specifically the Second World War. But I suppose I want to start the conversation, Amandi, by sort of just going back into the martial tradition of the people of the Punjab, particularly the Sikh peoples and their tradition of service. How far back does it stretch? And, you know, sort of how ancient is this martial tradition or martial culture? Why did it have such significance in the early 20th century and such importance?
In a sense, Joseph, the martial tradition of the Sikh faith goes back to the very origins of the faith itself. So the Sikh faith started in early 1500s, and it formed in the backdrop of Mughal invasion into the Punjab. So if you look at the Punjab, it's right up in the north of the kind of subcontinent of India, modern day India and Pakistan. And it's the kind of the entry point for most invaders into India. So as the faith was just beginning, there was actually quite a lot of conflict in India as Mughal invaders came in and eventually colonized India for 200 plus years. So as the faith grew up and as it emerged, and it emerged in many respects sort of challenging kind of existing faith traditions, both Hindu and Muslims in that period, it needed, in order to survive, to have a sense of that in order to survive, in order to flourish, it needed to be able to defend itself, also to defend others as well, because the Sikh faith is one that believes that there are many paths to enlightenment, and that these aren't to be suppressed by conversion or conquest. That was then formalized by about the early 1700s. Such that if you were to be baptized as a Sikh, if you were really sort of express that this was your sort of chosen faith, that you actually adopt the uniform of what was a soldier, modeled on the kind of Rajput notions of what a soldier was. So, you know, quite famously, people know that baptized Sikhs wear swords, and that comes from that period of the kind of early 1700s. But it's much more than that. It's much more than just the physical embellishment of swords or kind of a martial uniform. It's also just the notions that we must stand up against injustice and stand up for the justice of both of ourselves and for others as well.
I heard many years ago, and I don't know whether this is true, that it is in according to the Sikh faith and Sikh culture, but it was to do with Sikh culture and Sikh religious duty, that it was a Sikh duty when a Hindu's life was in danger or under threat, that it was the duty of a Sikh to defend a Hindu even at the peril of losing their own life. Is that true?
Well, I've not heard of it in those terms, but just the notion that Sikhs are there to defend righteousness is absolutely part of our faith. Not just Hindus, but the idea to stand up against injustice wherever that may play. And if that means physically standing up to injustice, that means physically standing up to injustice. And there have been many examples of that take place. And it's really that notion that you can be both religious and be a very sort of physically in the world. I think those were the notions that the Indian Army really, I'm going to say exploited, which sounds very exploitative. What I mean is that's what they kind of attached themselves to say that this was actually a righteous profession for Sikhs.
There is actually a notion that Sikh soldiers are somehow elite, that they are, you know, sort of an elite fighting force. Like when we think of Gurkhas or when we think of other martial cultures, I suppose you could, I'm from Ireland, you could also, this whole concept has been applied to Irish people serving in foreign armed forces or in the armed forces of various empires, including the British Empire. But there has been a widespread notion or feeling that Sikh soldiers are part of an elite military culture. Do Sikh people actually feel that same way about their tradition? Is there a feeling that the Sikh soldier is somehow elite in comparison to other types of soldier?
So I think there's just two things I'll say about that. One is, just to answer that question, I think there is genuine and real enduring pride about our martial heritage, both before joining the Indian Army, before the things that we're going to discuss around the First and Second World War, and sort of like the sort of native traditions, and then afterwards as well, which is quite unique in South Asia. There's a lot of reticence in South Asia, both in India and Pakistan, to acknowledge the role of Indian soldiers in those wars at times. So in the Sikhs, it's very different. But I think that notion goes back to the fact that the Sikh territories of Punjab were some of the last that were taken by the Brits as they colonized India. So that being almost the last of the sort of standouts. So I think that's probably where it comes from. And that was in 1849. And I only mention that date because if you know one thing about Indian history, you'll probably know 1857, which is only 8 years later, which was then the mutiny, which was this is the moment when the Indian Army kind of revolts against the British for a variety of reasons. And it was almost the moment that East India Company supremacy in India came to an end. And it was the Punjab and Sikhs that remained loyal in that, because it had only been 8 years since they'd been taken. They didn't feel the kinship with India. But I think though that event there in 57, when Sikhs and Punjabis remained loyal to the East India Company, the British, to put it loosely, gives them that kind of favoured status in the imagination of the British mind. So I think that's probably where some of those ideas come from.
That's very interesting. In the early 20th century, the turn of the century, a very young officer, he was also a journalist as well in his spare time, known as Winston Churchill, was a member of the Malakand Field Force. And he was serving under the, I suppose, the military leadership of a very famous, at the time, British Army general called Bindon Blood, who was actually from County Kerry in Ireland, actually originally part of this Anglo-Irish martial tradition. What happened anyway was, during an engagement, Churchill ended up pulling a wounded Sikh soldier from fire, pulling him back. And there's a funny story that the Sikh soldier complained and said, "You don't need to pull me out, I'm fine, I can take care of myself," and sort of picked himself up, though wounded, and carried himself off. So refusing aid from Churchill, I'm fine. And there is a sort of a kind of a bravado that's associated, yeah. many stories reported by British servicemen, British officers serving alongside Sikh troops during the 20th century and being very impressed with their durability, with their calm, their professionalism, their confidence, you know, in heated situations. I wanted to bring this on to the First World War and the role, I guess, that the Indian Army had in the First World War. And one of the things that I note in particular is the fact that really a cohort of Sikh soldiers were the first responders on behalf of the British Empire to the German incursions into northeastern France. And I wanted to ask you, would you be able to tell me a little bit about those early battles and the role that the Indian Army divisions and in particular Sikh soldiers within those divisions played, such as Neuve-Chapelle and places like that, and the role that they played in stopping the German advance and holding the line until they could be relieved?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let's pull back a little bit and just find out why is this tiny community, because Sikhs make up, you're doing a great job in bigging us up, but let's just get some numbers here. Okay. Sikhs made up in that period of time barely 1% of the Indian population, so a tiny community, massively over recruited, into the then Indian army. You talked about, you know, the army that Winston Churchill might have experienced. Some 20% of the standing army of India was made up of Sikhs.
That's incredible. Wow.
It's extraordinary. About 40% of that army is made up of Punjabis, just people from that one area. And often, you know what, we often get asked, you know, what does India think of the First World War? You know, this is a very contemporary question. And of course, India doesn't think of it because it's almost not an Indian war. It's almost more of a North Indian war, definitely a Punjabi war. So if you're down in the south of India, it just wasn't a thing that was happening. Your boys were not getting recruited.
So let me come in there. So actually, India's experience, or at least India as it was then prior to partition, its experience of possibly both world wars is contingent on how many people from a particular region actually served in the armed forces or served the war effort. That in another region, they might have had no experience of it at all. And then it's literally not part of their memory. It doesn't feature because they have no connection to it.
Certainly in the First World War, the army as it stood then at the turn of the century was a function of very deliberate recruiting patterns in certain parts of the country, which were looking at what they then called martial races. So these were people that were seen as being manly enough to be admitted into the army, which is a high status role. So Punjabis, probably because of their sort of positive response in 1857, were seen as both, you know, the right kind of material and having shown loyalty. Whereas Bengalis at the time, this isn't the case in the Second World War, but definitely at the time, were remarked upon as being effeminate. Now, that's probably there because they were actually quite educated. So there's also, you know, there's usefulness in having people who are ill-educated, unlikely to kind of form any kind of resistance against the British, but also showing the right kinds of qualities as well. So, yeah, the First World War is really a very regional experience for people throughout India. It's also, that recruitment is also a function of another Irishman, actually, Joseph. So you might be interested in that. The Governor General of the Punjab at the time, I don't know if we're going to get onto this, was Sir Michael O'Dwyer, raced through the Indian civil service system and had put in very successful, assertive recruitment mechanisms into the Punjab, such that during the First World War, it was recruiting so heavily. And so we do get, to go back to your original question, you know, an army which is 40% Punjabi and about half of that number are indeed Sikh. So, you know, one in every five of that Indian army is a Sikh man, despite making up about 1%.
It's just an absolutely incredible statistic. It's difficult to wrap your head around it, really. I honestly did not know that. I knew that there was a very, very large proportion of the Indian military or the army of the Raj that was made up of Sikh soldiers, disproportionately so, but I had no idea it was to that extent. It really does reflect very strongly. Now, what I wanted to do was ask how that carries forward into the Second World War. I know that the Second World War isn't necessarily your field compared with the First World War. I think you said that. I wanted to ask you, in terms of Sikh gallantry and also the awards that were given to people from the Punjab generally during the Second World War, it's very clear from the number of VCs that were won by Punjabi soldiers during the Second World War that there were, again, this region of India or this region of the Raj is showing up as being, you know, producing some of the heavy hitters in terms of Indian soldiers that are performing superbly on the battlefield in Europe, in North Africa, and in parts of the Far East, including sort of the campaigns at Imphal, Kohima, and then later in Burma. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how this tradition continued in spite of the politics of independence that were ongoing during the interwar period? I'd like to hear a little bit more about this.
It's a great question. And, you know, if you look at there's a strong thread that runs through the First and Second World War in terms of recruitment and why people do it. It's really interesting because if you look at the First World War as a start point, the general narrative is, you know, India joins the First World War and 1.5 million men volunteer for it, quote unquote volunteer, because there's a quid pro quo, right? That this might be the route to at least dominion status, which is a pathway to some form of independence. But actually, there's a very interesting cache of interviews at the British Library, which were conducted in the 1970s by American researchers to ask veterans of the First World War, why did you join? Right. So from the men themselves, of course, they're not talking about that. The men themselves are joining up for all the reasons that young men join armies. Right. So it's pay, it's pension, it's status. This was a high status role in the environment when there is not much options. This is great. And of course, guns, glory and travel and all the reasons that people are doing it. So those interviews are fascinating insights into the minds of those men. My grandfather's brother joined up in the First World War from a tiny village in the east of the Punjab. And I think I understand why. I never met him and never spoke to him. Nobody ever asked him really why he joined, but I can almost guess. He's one of four brothers. There's a small amount of not terribly fertile land. Brother one gets married. Brothers two, three, and four are destined never to get married. The family will not marry them off because that will mean splitting up their bit of land. So if that's the environment that you're growing up into, then what is your life really going to be? One of the brothers become a camel trader and lives his life kind of a bachelor for the rest of his life. And one of them joins the army and receives pay and pension and status and a uniform. So within the environment of the kind of Sikh community, it's not even just status. There's a religious righteousness about it. And I'm sure that religious righteousness trumps even the sort of nationalistic reasons not to do it. And of course, O'Dwyer was just a genius in setting up an environment within which my grandfather's brother, anyone with any status in the state, would be telling them, you must join the army, you must fight. So it's no surprise that you get this huge amount of recruitment going on in the Punjab. In Rawalpindi, which is now up in Pakistan, the level of volunteers of recruitable aged men was greater than that of men who were volunteers and conscripted in England and Wales. The fervour amongst, and these are not Sikhs, these are Muslims largely, the fervour, the excitement, the interest in joining, and you know, 99%+ would have been volunteers, active volunteers. So when the Second World War comes along, now, of course, between the First and the Second World War, there are lots of very high profile. The world has changed very dramatically in India. So they've had a lot more nationalistic activity and a lot of sort of colonial violence as well. A lot of it in the north of India. So these men would have seen it, but there was almost no diminishing in that fervour to join. And almost twice as many men joined the Indian Army in the Second World War as joined in the First, and pretty well the split amongst the communities was much the same. And interestingly, you mentioned the conflict in Southeast Asia. It was also those men from the Punjab, who also joined the Indian National Army, which was this enormous counter movement against the Indian Army that was largely fueled by the Germans and the Japanese as well, particularly in Burma. So by the Second World War, whilst there was a similar kind of level of fervour, there was greater recruitment that took place, there was also a much more significant anti-war voice, some of it really very serious.
I wanted to just ask you, do you think that during the Second World War, the voluntary service, because recently we put out a tweet which got a massive response, but it also got a few questions. There were a few interested responses to kind of question the figure. 2.5 million voluntary recruits, said to be the largest volunteer army in human history. This is the Indian Army of the Second World War. But others have disputed this, saying that, you know, the British Army in the First World War was actually technically the largest with 2.7 million voluntary recruits. But then the technicality of that is, of course, the fact that many, there are quite a number of those who joined after having been conscripted. And then another person pointed out that the US Navy and Marine Corps in the Second World War was also a massive volunteer cohort, larger than that. But then the point is that that's a Navy and a Marine Corps, not an army. So again, sort of brings us back to the Indian Army being the largest volunteer army in history, or so it is said. What do you think about this particular statistic? Is it correct? Is it something that needs to be verified again? And if it is indeed correct, what does that say about the nature of military service in India during the Second World War? Is it something that could have only have been voluntary? And is it possible that we could describe India during the Second World War as a country that felt it had to fight the Second World War, but did so reluctantly, or was at war, but there's a term, being at war, but skulking? What do you make of this particular question?
There's a comparative element to this. I am way out of my area of knowledge there. So let's put that to one side. What numbers you had in the US Navy. I think it's, I was interested in the responses that you got to that, because first of all, there's this reaction to the word volunteer. Were they really volunteers? And that's partly, there's a very strong Indian narrative at the moment. And it does come from India, the state of India, not Pakistan, where there is a general kind of reticence to sort of lionize the Indian response to war now. It wasn't the case 10 years ago, but it's very strong now. It's a much more nationalistic country than it was even a decade ago. And so there's lots of, the word volunteer sort of sticks in the throat a little bit. And there is evidence that there was almost press ganging going on. There were pressures put on people. If you take Punjab, in Michael O'Dwyer's Punjab, there were recruitment targets that were cascaded down, right down to the village level. So you put those kinds of pressures on the administrative system, and this is on the civil administrative system, you get bad behavior. There's no question about it. And I'm sure some people were compelled to do things because of debt, because of family pressures or whatever. And there's evidence that took place. But by and large, we're looking at a volunteer army, certainly in the First World War. It's really interesting about this idea of an army that's at war but skulking. Again, when you go to the sort of the actual soldiers' voices themselves, of which there are precious few, unfortunately, they don't see it that way. They see it actually. So certainly those that remained loyal to the Indian Army, there were obviously some that stepped away from that. But for those that remained loyal, they didn't see it that. They saw it as a profession that they were embarking on. They felt very proud of that position. So there wasn't a sense they were compelled to do it, but they're also operating inside an environment where, you know, the entire state, the apparatus of the state, right the way down to village level, is telling them that this is the right thing to do. So it's a difficult one, but I don't think it's skulking. But there is a very significant number of the Indian Army that then essentially revolts during the Second World War and forms something called the Indian National Army. Now, particularly after the fall of Singapore, where the Indians were kind of caught out, the British retreated, which did revolt against their place in the British Empire forces, and they formed the Indian National Army. So I call them a small number, but I think of tens of thousands of men who are very prominent in today's telling of the Second World War from an Indian perspective, because they're seen as being the kind of proto freedom fighters for independence later on. But at the time, they weren't seen in those terms, both in Southeast Asia fighting against the Japanese, but also some within Europe that were used mainly for propaganda by the Germans as being much more loyal to India as a future nation state than those that were under the yoke of the British Empire, as they would have put it. So that's much more evident in the Second World War than you see in the First World War.
Could I ask you again, this is going on to something that you referred to, few voices. And this is something that's quite troubling when it comes to the subject of India during the Second World War, that there are remarkably few voices that we come across. And again, now I don't have personal experience, I haven't researched this in depth, but it is said again and again that there are precious few oral histories with Indian veterans of the Second World War, or for that matter, Pakistani or Bangladeshi or even Sri Lankan veterans. It's a common problem across all four countries. And there's a general, apparently the lack of willingness to engage with this culture stems from the fact that for a long time, it seemed to have been taboo to talk about it. I was just wondering what you make of all of this. What do you think are the reasons why, I suppose, the history and heritage, the memory of those who fought in the World Wars, was particularly the Second World War, was buried post-independence and post-partition?
Yeah, I mean, I think overarching issue is just this very imperialistic attitude where the voices of higher status people tend to get captured. So you do see Indian voices, but they are the kind of the very, very high status. These are the princes and the Maharajas who put their uniforms on and largely recruited rather than obviously participated. Whereas the huge majority of that 1.5 million were largely voiceless. So there's little scraps of evidence about them, but they weren't asked and it wasn't captured. And I think that's just a very imperialistic attitude that sadly was very evident in the first and second, in that period of the First and Second World War. You've got to also remember that the men were largely uneducated or unable to write. So they would use educated men within the regiment in order to write letters backwards and forwards, or there are almost like these pro forma type postcards where you could tick, I am okay, please write back. So, and with that, you just don't get a lot of their voices captured. There were attempts made at sort of reminiscence work, more so for veterans of the Second World War. As I alluded to earlier, there's some very exciting, largely unpublished accounts from the First World War as well, but they're 50 or 60 years after the events took place and after independence took place. So, you know, you've got memory and you've got political events colouring what actually happened. But I would say that this is an area, and we found this, researching on the First and Second World, largely because there has been a reluctance, a taboo, as you put it, to engage on this topic inside the countries of South Asia, that there are still unexplored archives. So about 10 years ago, we came to learn of an archive that was in Pakistan that had somehow survived independence and partition and all of that kind of, you know, the maelstrom events that took place there, which listed the names of every man from the Punjab that went to war in the First World War. The man's name, his father's name, the caste he belonged to. So all of those markers of identity and the village that they came from. This is tremendously exciting because this lets you finally identify people. So my great uncle, who I mentioned earlier on in this interview, we knew nothing about. It was my dad mentioned it to me. And even when he mentioned it, we thought, no, that can't be right. But there you go. You look up the village, this tiny little village in the east of Punjab. You go there and you find Bishan Singh, son of Jaddi, from the village Madhpur, and this is the regiment he fought in, and suddenly his history opens up, and it's an extraordinary moment, and we have that for 300,000 men that fought.
300,000.
Yeah, and we've started to put that online so that families can now start to reconnect to their First World War heritage. And I, you know, the most asked question is there a version of this for the Second World War? And I always answer it in the same way, which is, I don't know of one. But equally, we didn't know about this until 10 years ago. So it's the exciting thing about this particular topic is there is still so much to unearth.
I think the question I'd probably ask, because this is the kind of work I like to do, is like, did somebody or did groups of people go around with tape recorders to particular parts of, you know, India or Pakistan or Bangladesh and start interviewing Second World War veterans the way many of us did with our veterans? did people do that work on the ground? Are there oral history collections that we don't know about that have been gathered in the last number of years? And is it still possible to gather oral history? Maybe it still is. Maybe it's not too late. We're still doing oral history now. It's getting up to the 11th hour, but it's still being done. But this brings me to a final point, which is the work of the UK Punjab Heritage Association, the work that you've been doing to delve into the heritage of the people of the Punjab, which is a contested region to this day, effectively broken partition between two nation states. It was a very sad legacy of partition, but this was, as you've pointed out in our early discussion, a very proud region of the former Raj, and certainly a lot of very, very esteemed contributions to the war efforts of, you know, the Britain in the First and Second World War. So could you tell me a little bit more about the work of the association? What kind of projects have you been leading? And could you tell us anything, share with us what you're working on now at the moment?
Oh, yeah, thank you. So we started off just because the region of Punjab is interesting for so many reasons, as you rightly mentioned. But another one is that the material heritage of the Punjab is here in the United Kingdom. A lot of it is here in the United Kingdom. And that's a legacy of annexation in 1849, as well as just the British obsession with picking things up, bringing them back and carefully cataloguing them, putting them on a shelf. So we have this very rich source that we like to, we're able to get access to. So the bulk of our work is about finding material heritage that's here in the UK, making that available, making sure that we research it, treasuring it, educating our communities, connecting collections with the communities that are for which those artifacts or those archives are of great importance. So we've done everything from physical exhibitions, multiple physical exhibitions in London on various topics. In 2014, we did a whole thing on the First World War and the Sikh community because of the centenary and everything that throws up. We've got a couple more coming up, which we'll be happy to announce once we're able to make this public. We had a publications program, which has been very rich and has published on all of those. And probably the thing that we're most well known of, it's almost accidental, is that during lockdown, at the beginning of lockdown, when culture just started to switch off and everyone moved onto this thing called Zoom, which no one had ever heard of before, we did this thing every Monday, 5 o'clock. We would bring a moment of culture into people's lives with just a 1 hour book club, we used to call it, where just an author would come in and just talk about their work for an hour. And of course, everyone could engage with that as well. So we would have 1,000 to 2,000 people on every Monday, listening to someone and then questioning that person about it as well. We'd have an esteemed author, a museum curator, a PhD student, somebody who was otherwise perhaps invisible to our community. And they would bring an hour's talk about what they had worked on and what they were working on. And it was a way for people both to listen in a long form interview, which is so rare these days, but also to engage with them as well. So we would have 1,000 to 2,000 people on those calls every week. And we kept that going pretty well for the 2 years of various ups and downs over lockdown. So that's the kind of work we do, where we try to engage the community with just the really brilliant work that goes on sometimes undercover in our academic institutions or national collections.
That must have been a great comfort to quite a lot of people during lockdown, and also something new. It's a wonderful idea, actually, in terms of engaging a sort of a wider online community. Very last question, last thoughts. What's the best way to engage the wider South Asian community to embrace a project like Their Finest Hour and get them to contribute their undoubtedly very rich stories, which are, as I've said many times, are not well known enough? What's the best way to do it?
I think it's absolutely about consistency. It's absolutely about partnerships. There are very trusted groups, not just mine. The South Asian Heritage Month is a group that has built an awful lot of trust with the community in what they're doing. So I think it's consistency, it's partnerships, and it's feeding back as well, because I think once you see other people doing it, I think that will excite and engage people further.
Thank you very much for your time, Amandeep. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. I've loved every minute of it.
Cheers.
There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover tomorrow, just you wait. wait and see.